Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Have a seat, everybody. Today, I wanted to talk with you about something very important from the Torah portion, and I'd like to talk with you about Messianic Judaism for the long haul. And by that, I mean the long haul of your life and my life. And I'd like to distill a lesson from our Torah portion about how we can keep our faith alive and passionate and meaningful in a world which really doesn't take faith in God very seriously. You know, most of the inputs we get would suggest that all of this is not terribly important. Maybe you've had this experience of someone close to you who was a follower of the Messiah, and then a year or two later, they just drifted away. And you wonder, how did that happen? I've had that experience. I remember when I went to college in Ithaca, New York, in 1971, in August, I became a follower of Yeshua, went back to school, and the experience was slipping away from me until I met a fellow named Saul. I won't give you his last name. Saul. I made a new friend, a guy named Danny, trumpet player. He said, you got to meet my crazy roommate. He's really an interesting guy. And so there I was. And let's just say my brain was not functioning quite the way it should. 1971. Do I have to really spell it out for you? All right. It was a long time ago because I had slipped back into some bad patterns. And I was walking around Saul's room, and on the study carousel was a little black book with a gold edge, and I looked at it, and it was a copy of the scriptures. And I didn't think there were any of these north of the New Jersey border where I had become a follower of the Messiah. And Saul was sitting there in his skimpies and flimsies, and Saul had a big, I called it an Isro. It wasn't an Afro, it was an Isro, you know. You know what I mean? It was in Israel. And I walked up to him and I said, are you a believer? And he went, yeah, are you? And I said, yeah, but don't bug me. I got to do things on my own time. Really, that's Emes. That's exactly what I said. This is your rabbi. But it's confessions from a long time ago. A long time ago, 1971, September. Next thing I know, he brought me to a group of believers, and from that point I made teshuvah, and I haven't looked back since. But Saul, who was so instrumental, a year later had completely forsaken his Messianic Jewish faith. And Danny had become a follower of Yeshua also at that same time, around when I did, and he disappeared too. Have you had that experience? Yeah. And it's very painful and very difficult, but the question is, again, how do we raise the likelihood, increase the probability that when it's time to go home and be with God, we will have continued in our faith? How do you do it? Well, again, our Torah passage gives us some indication. So you have Israel being brought out of Egypt, miracles, 10 plagues, crossing of the Red Sea, phenomenal stuff going on left and right. And God says at some point, and he says, go send spies into the land to take a look, and let's get some, you need some good intelligence if you're going to enter the land and fight with the local inhabitants. And so 12 people who were leaders in the community were chosen, and they went north and south and east and west and came back. And maybe you've seen this, the image of a huge cluster, an eshkol, a cluster of grapes suspended on a piece of wood and people carrying it. You know what I'm talking about? You've seen that, haven't you? A big thing of grapes. That image, of course, is from this particular account. The good report came. What a land. It's beautiful. It is the land of milk and honey. Two of the men, Joshua and Caleb, were all excited. But the other men, though admitting that it was a really terrific land, said, hey, listen, this whole enterprise is going to fail. Forget about it. There are big people there. Even the Nephilim, and that's a very interesting group of people that we don't know a whole lot about, but giants, big, big people. The ten say, we saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Amalek came from the Nephilim. We seem like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we look the same to them. And I've always wondered, how did they know how they looked to the local inhabitants? Did they ask? Excuse me, sir, we're taking a survey. Do we look like grasshoppers to you? You get four choices, grasshoppers, antelopes, or, you know, it wasn't that way. They didn't take a poll. What we find here is what's called projection bias. We project what we imagine others feel and think about us onto them. Oh, we see all kinds of recognized logical fallacies in the TENS report. We kind of find confirmation bias. You ever hear of confirmation bias? It means that you tend to hold on to those ideas that you initially grab onto, even if they're proven wrong, the strong gravitation is to hold on to them. And so they started with a bad idea, and even though Joshua and Caleb have a wonderful argument for continuing on, they hold on to it. They have in-group bias. They reinforced one another's misconceptions. They have a negativity bias. We're all prone to liking to see more bad news than good news on TV, you know. It's a sad reality, but it is an unfortunate truth. And so they gravitated toward bad news. So you have all of these dimensions. But then we have, again, Joshua and Caleb. Now, these are two guys of the 12 who had faith that everything was going to be okay. And we want to look at the dynamics, and we're using a little bit of imagination here because we weren't there and we didn't interview them, but it's not too difficult to discern that their faith came from thinking deeply about what has been. Thinking deeply about what has been. The evidence that presented itself to them and to all Israel. And so, they say this, the land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and he will give it to us. Only, they say, don't rebel against the Lord and do not be afraid of the people in the land, because we will devour them. Here's the critical point. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them. And all of that begs the question, and I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to ask you just to call it out, why is it that Joshua and Caleb were so sure that the Lord is with us and there's no need to be afraid of these very tall inhabitants of the land? What is the basis of their confidence? They've been trusting God, yes, right? But what have they seen? That's what I want to know. What have they seen? They saw the Exodus. What else? How about that pillar of fire that led them along in the wilderness? What else? Provision in the wilderness, right? To name a few things. I mean, they lived this stuff. And so what we can distill from this is that they acted on the basis of the truth that was objectively, clearly, unambiguously real, and they were not going to let their fear or the pressure of the group or any of the logical fallacies that we had talked about, they were not going to allow those things to dominate their thinking. They knew what they saw, and they were going for it. The question then is, what about us? Will we finish our lives as passionate, committed followers of Yeshua the Messiah? That's really the question that I want to interact with you. Now, the key concept here is Zachor, remember, remember. Remember what? Again, it's the things that they knew objectively and truly to be so that gave them the koach, or the strength, to be able to say, hey, we can take this land, no sweat, we've got this. And again, the question is us. Now again, letting you know a little bit about my own early journey, this became very important to me. When I was in Ocean City, New Jersey, that summer of 1971, I ran into a Messianic Jewish leader. Some of you know him. His name is John Fisher. He's a good friend, and we've been friends for 40-something years now since that day. I met his friends. They were part of a group telling young people on the beach about Yeshua. And one of the things they gave me was a little book, and it was called Jesus and the Intellectual. And what it was a brief summary of some of the famous people in history who had decided they wanted to disprove this whole Yeshua myth. And one of them was General Lew Wallace. He was a Civil War general, and he's the guy who wrote Ben-Hur. But earlier on, he became a real skeptic, and he wanted to disprove all of this stuff. All of this stuff is nonsense, and I'm guessing, I have not read a more extensive biography of him, I'm guessing that the trauma of the Civil War could have really energized his motivation. How could a good God allow such carnage? Because Civil War is the worst kind of war. Of any kind of war, Civil War is the worst. And so my guess is that he was motivated because of the horrors of the Civil War to write about this. And so he started studying the issue. And when he looked at the evidence for the resurrection of Yeshua actually being a historical event, he did a 180 and said, you know, the facts don't fit what I thought to be true. I thought the whole thing was just a religious myth, like Adonis and the Corn King and these other mythological things from Greek mythology and whatnot. And he did a 180 and he said, you know, the resurrection really happened. I mean, the evidence for it is so strong in history. And again, he wrote Jesus and the Intellectual. And that meant a lot to me, and I hope it can mean something to you for reasons that we'll explore a little further as we go here. Now, you know, what about the book that talks about all that stuff that Yeshua did? Can you trust it? I mean, it's an ancient book, and I think a lot of people feel, nah, you know, you can't trust it. It was written long after the event, they would imagine. It's not true. And it was written by people who had a bias, and it's been copied so many times, who knows what they originally wrote. Maybe you've entertained some of those thoughts. I want to tell you, they're unnecessary. And I'm not going to take a whole lot of time it would take quite a while to defend what I'm saying in any detail, but I'll just give you a couple of examples, or one particular example. One good way to figure out if something written a long time ago has some solidity, some reality to it, is to compare it with other things written at the same time in terms of things like, well, how many manuscripts are there? Ancient manuscripts, all this is, you know, pre-printing press, because the number of manuscripts is critically important because scholars compare them with each other, and that's how they try and figure out what the original was. So there was a writer back in the same rough period as Yeshua, and his name was Tacitus. Maybe you've heard of him, Roman historian. He wrote around the year 100, but the earliest manuscript we have of his, the earliest written manuscript, comes from 1,000 years later. 1,000 years. Well, the earliest manuscript from the New Testament, the John Rylands Papyri, is roughly from 125, the year 125. In other words, relatively speaking, a very short time after the events that it described. It's from the Gospel of John. And when we talk about the number of manuscripts that can be compared to each other, for Tacitus, we got 20. I want to give you the exact number of manuscripts we have partial or complete manuscripts of the New Testament, which are compared together. And at the last count that I was able to find, 5,686 manuscripts. That's a lot of manuscripts. Describing events within a relatively short time. No thousand-year gap. None of that kind of stuff. And so, I want to suggest to you that this stuff is real because the manuscript evidence is so strong. And I'm going to give you some other things that speak to me, and I hope they speak to you. I love this stuff because, well, for reasons I'll explain a little bit later. But how about this? Have you ever noticed how the Gospels have a ring of truth because they don't just include the heroes and his followers' victory followed by victory followed by victory? Rather, they have what you would expect if the whole story was real. They have other people saying, nah, I think he does it by Beelzebub. Nah, he's just trying to bilk the people. The fact that those kind of things are recorded in the testimony about Yeshua is an indication that his earliest followers were very truth-motivated people, and they wanted to give you the story, the real story of what really happened. And his followers, instead of being great heroes who just get it, how are they presented? They're presented as not getting it at all until after the resurrection they begin to get it. You see? And how people respond to Yeshua, there's just what I like to call is just a ring of truth. It's the kind of thing you would read if it really was true. And there are so many other things we can mention, but I just want to mention one more to you that has been very meaningful to me, and maybe you'll look at it and you'll find it meaningful as well. It's called the Shroud of Turin. Have you ever heard of it before? How many of you, raise your hand, tell me if you've heard it. Some have heard of it, some haven't. So let me tell you what it is very briefly. In history, you can follow the route of this thing to various places, but in Turin, Italy, is a 14-foot by 3-foot piece of cloth. It's a piece of linen cloth woven in the way that linen would have been woven in the first century, called a herringbone twill, very unique to that time of period. And it has the reverse image of a man on it that was held to be a genuine relic for many years. But what really got people's attention was in 1898, a photographer took a picture of it during a public exhibition, those exhibitions are somewhat rare, and he took a picture of it and almost dropped his glass plate negative when he noticed that the picture that he took in reverse was the actual picture, and it had amazing anatomical detail of a man who was crucified. And the detail is striking. It is absolutely striking. The wounds on the person's body fit Yeshua. And for example, in medieval art, you'll notice most of the time when there's a depiction of Yeshua crucified, the nails are through his hand. But in the image of the shroud, the nails are through Destot's spot, a place where four bones come together, which would be able to hold the body of a person who was crucified, where the hands could not. So, in other words, in the Middle Ages, you did have a depiction of Yeshua, but with a wrong anatomical detail. And the 100 examples of the flagellation, a Roman flagrum, with little pieces of bone or metal ripping at the victim, and all of that is perfectly delineated on the shroud. It is the most striking thing. And in 1978, a team of scientists from places like the Jet Propulsion Lab in New Mexico, they went and they took what's called a VP8 image analyzer, and this device was able to show that the shroud has encoded within it something that is unlike anything in history, totally unique, not like anything. It has three dimensionality encoded right into it. That is, that the relative distance of the markings fits the actual contours of an actual body. There is no painting, there's no pigment. The image was formed by a burst of some kind of radiation or light that just scorched the uppermost fibrils of the linen. And I could go on and on, but it is really an amazing thing. And I have been very, very encouraged by all that. So let me conclude by asking a related question. How do we lose the big wow of our faith? How do people lose it? I want to tell you something. Most people don't lose their faith because all of a sudden new evidence comes and they go, I thought this was true, but it's not. That's not the way it happens. It happens largely through a slow process of inattention to the question of truth. That's how it happens. My friends did not lose their faith because all of a sudden some new data came in which showed that Yeshua was a phony. That was not it. It's a process over time where when you start out and you're excited about him and you're excited about the implications for being Jewish and him, all that grabs you. But then what can happen is over time, because of inattention, it's not that you don't believe it at some level, it's that it doesn't matter anymore. And then you begin relating primarily to a community of people for whom it doesn't matter anymore, and then it reinforces that those dynamics that just ultimately lead to it doesn't matter, and you don't care. And whether it's true or not is not even important enough to look at. It's an amazing thing. You wonder how it can happen, but it's a function of God's gift of freedom to the human race that we can lose that passion. It's a matter of inattention. And obviously, our society is horrible at helping us maintain attention to anything deeply because of the sheer amount of information we get through our electronic devices. Yet another story. Now, there were real giants in the land. The place was dangerous. But Joshua and Caleb had at the front of their minds the evidence that God is real and he would not let Israel down. And that is how they kept it together. We often, at Ruach, and rightly so, validate our faith by calling attention to the personal experiences we've had which assure us that God, through Messiah, is with us. I'm thinking of answered prayer, or Sue's testimony last week about an amazing series of circumstances which came together that showed her that as she's moving into retirement, she has a real important role in the future that will be revealed to her. All of that is really important stuff, and we emphasize it and we celebrate it. But today, I'm calling you to give attention to another way of knowing and of staying excited and motivated for the Messianic Jewish journey till the day you pass from this world into the next world. It's the lesson we learn from Joshua and Caleb. It is choosing to see the larger picture of truth set before you and to respond every day to that truth by saying yes to the God of truth. Or another way of saying this is thinking and feeling are both important in knowing the truth. But today we're talking about thinking, of responding to the evidences that God has provided, showing us that our Messianic Jewish faith works because it is true. And it is true even when things happen which don't seem to work, like having to face the Nephilim, or not having enough money, or having to deal with difficult people, or getting that unexpected phone call from the doctor. Live in truth. Truth is emet in Hebrew. Live for truth, live in truth, because truth will ultimately not fail you. Frankly, truth, it's the only way to live. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Of the house of Israel, and may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.